from San Francisco. I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Los Angeles is considered to be the first modern American city. It's modern because its first great boom days were in the 1920s, when the burgeoning film industry and a multitude of oil wells fueled the economy. At the same time, outrageous promises were made to investors through the newly minted form of the tabloid, and individuals were affected by the first ever radio evangelists, all means of communication not possible before. Today I'll speak with Dr. Jules Tigel. A professor of history at San Francisco State, he recounts courtroom murders, shady characters, bigger-than-life pillars of the community, and a Shanghai suicide. Without technology, Los Angeles might have been just another sleepy little town. Later, I'll speak with Christine Maxwell and Larry Magid. Larry writes the syndicated column Computer File, which appears in the Washington Post and numerous other publications worldwide, while Christine Maxwell is president and CEO of Research on Demand. We'll figure out how many books about the internet you have to buy to get the information you're looking for. Professor Jules Tigel's most recent book is called The Great Los Angeles Swindle. In it, he recounts the dramatic scandal surrounding the Julian Petroleum Corporation. I asked him to paint a picture of Los Angeles in the 1920s.
Well, Los Angeles had already emerged as a fairly large city at the dawn of the 1920s. In the county itself, there were probably about 1 million people. But in the aftermath of World War I, the city boomed on an unprecedented level. A number of things fueled the boom. Hollywood, of course, was flourishing, tremendous real estate boom. Agriculture and banking were developing, but most important was oil. There were three massive oil strikes right on the outskirts of the city, one in Long Beach, one in Huntington Beach, and one at Santa Fe Springs. And never before had there been major mineral strikes like this within a half an hour's drive of a major American city. And this created a tremendous sensation, which helped to fuel this boom. And within a few years, the city was pushing about 2 million people and had become a major American metropolis.
Looking at the picture on the cover of your book, we see these wooden oil wells, the oil drilling apparatus sort of going out into the horizon. What did that look like?
If you went to Signal Hill, which was the big field just outside of Long Beach, the whole hill was just covered with oil derricks. And prior to the Los Angeles oil boom, the usual rule of thumb was you would have one derrick for every 5 acres. In Los Angeles, the derricks could be a few hundred yards, even 50 yards apart. Sometimes they ended up pumping each other's oil. So it was a very tight congestion, in part because this land had already been subdivided. Often oil was discovered on these vast plains in the public domain or where one owner owned all the land. In Los Angeles, where subdivision was sort of the national pastime in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the people who wanted to develop this oil had to deal with a lot of small landowners. And so there was lots of opportunity for not only large companies, but for small independent people to come in and drill their wells.
Now, against this backdrop, tell us about the Julian Petroleum Swindle.
Well, it operates on several levels, and it begins with C.C. Julian, who was a master promoter, mainly from newspaper advertising. And he was an independent operator who secured a lease at Santa Fe Springs, which was the biggest of the three fields, and drilled three wells there, promising to make his investors rich. And lo and behold, all three of those wells, and then two more he drilled, all hit oil. And he became sort of the crown prince of the oil promoters. And he decided to move on from there to create a company which he claimed would rival Standard Oil, called the Julian Petroleum Corporation. And Julian himself was one of the most well-known and colorful figures in Los Angeles in the 1920s. He was flamboyant. He had always accompanied by actresses and hopping around nightclubs and driving around in fancy cars. He was a wonderful dresser, as you can see from his pictures in the book. And the Julian Petroleum Company attracted about 30,000 to 40,000 investors, many of whom just invested their life savings thinking that Julian was going to make them rich. But there was a good deal of suspicion very early on that Julian was not all that he claimed to be. And he was ultimately driven out of his company by a combination of investigations by state authorities, federal authorities, and he turned the company over to S.C. Lewis, who, with his associate Jacob Berman, really began to use the company as the basis for a very wild pyramiding of stock overissues, loans, investment pools, which vastly overissued the stock and led to the collapse of the company.
But in this book, there are murders and suicides and con artists. And I mean, it just goes on. And there are small guys who are just little investors, and things happen to them, and politicians get involved.
Right, and some very prominent names invested in the company. Cecil B. DeMille was an investor. Louis B. Mayer was a member of the so-called million-dollar pool, along with people like Harry Haldeman, who was the grandfather of H.R. Haldeman of Watergate fame. The story involves people. T.C. Julian has a wonderful fistfight with Charlie Chaplin at the Cafe Petrushka, with Yasha Heifetz and Mary Miles Minter and many other celebrities sitting on. And of course, many of Los Angeles's top politicians, underworld figures, people like Charlie Crawford, who is known as the Gray Wolf of the underworld, Robert Shula, one of the first radio evangelists, is very heavily involved in the exposés of the scandal. So this scandal itself really cut across many levels of Los Angeles history, carried over into state and national politics.
On a scale of 1 to 10, I don't know what it would be. How big was this scandal at the time?
Well, on a scale of 1 to 10, it's probably at least an 8 or a 9, and in terms of its complexities and the wonderful twists and turns it takes, I would say it's probably a 12. But I think we have to realize that the figures given usually is that this was a $150 million scandal. If we translate that into modern terms, we're talking about a multi-billion dollar scandal. So it would be comparable to much of the savings, many of the savings and loans, individual savings and loan scandals. It's the type of scandal that if it had happened in New York on the New York Stock Exchange, would be part of the national folklore. But because it was hidden away in California and hidden away in Los Angeles, which very few people paid attention to in the 1920s, and which much of our national history and folklore still ignores, it's largely been forgotten.
My guest today is Jules Teigel. He's a professor at San Francisco State University in history, and his latest book is The Great Los Angeles Swindle. You know, I'm fascinated by how Los Angeles at this moment in time was transformed because you were able to find oil and profitable kinds of things and drill for it. I mean, movie making, without technology, there would be no industry. And it's as if this was a sleepy little town with orchards for years and years and years. And suddenly, new industries came in and changed the whole fabric of the society.
It would be a mistake to see L.A. by 1920 as a sleepy little town. What's unusual, beginning in the 1880s, Los Angeles had become one of the fastest growing cities in the United States. What was unusual about its growth between 1880 and 1920 is that it was in many ways the first modern city, the first city based on things like service and tourism. In essence, Los Angeles was growing on growth itself. There were so many people, the Chamber of Commerce had launched massive advertising campaigns to encourage people to come and settle in Los Angeles, to encourage tourists, tourism was just beginning in the late 19th century. We were just beginning to have a middle class which had the money, which had the time to take a few weeks off for vacation. In fact, prior to the 1920s, it was primarily a winter haven. People would be escaping the cold Midwest and come in the winter. Beginning in the 1920s, they formed the All-Year Club, which promoted it as an all-year tourist attraction. At about the same time, we're beginning to see people who are getting paid vacations in the summers. So prior to the 1920s, Los Angeles is growing rapidly, but it's growing without a real industrial base. Beginning with World War I and the early 1920s, several industries begin to emerge. And, for example, the shipping industry, the port of Los Angeles didn't really have a port prior to the early 20th century when they built a man-made port at San Pedro. By the end of the 1920s, San Pedro had outstripped San Francisco as the leading port on the West Coast.
Everybody knows the movie Chinatown. I mean, we're all familiar with it. Is this another kind of Chinatown?
It's a Chinatown in oil, in that Chinatown, of course, deals with the water wars in Los Angeles, with the controversy surrounding the development of the Owens Valley project, though it's very loosely based on that. They moved the events about 20 years later. But this is the same era that the movie Chinatown takes place in. And in many ways, shows of Los Angeles very similar to what Chinatown shows, with a very dark underside, a city that is growing rapidly, perhaps too rapidly for its own social good, and one in which the infrastructure can't quite hold the tremendous economic, technological, cultural energies that are unleashed by the hundreds of thousands of people just flooding into Los Angeles looking for opportunity.
Very early on in the book, it was talking about how Motley Flint started very early financing the films. And he was saying to very important people that we would recognize, I don't care. I know you're going down the right alley. I know you're doing this and you're doing that. And they invested in the talking pictures. It doesn't strike me as strange to have some of those big names and then have Motley go up to him and say, hey, could you put a dime over here?
Sure, and he organized the million-dollar pool and brought in people like Louis B. Mayer. And this is, of course, part of the Los Angeles business elite and the way many of the companies operated. You have interlocking boards of directors. You have a business elite which meets for lunches at the California Club. And when they hear that there's an investment which can yield them a quick profit, many of the people are willing to put some money in there, some not even thinking about it, but some thinking very, very clearly and willing to take the risks. And somebody like Motley Flint, who is one of the giants of early financing of the film industry, really is ruined in many ways by his involvement with the Julian Petroleum scandal, and in the end is assassinated in a courtroom assassination because of his role in the Julian scandal.
Well, I think my point is that when money is flowing many different ways, I'm giving you big loans over here and I know we're all making money out of it, then when I ask you to kind of pitch in over here and get involved, well, then you're going to. It's all kind of, this is good business. And then that enables that person to turn around and say, well, Louis B. Mayer, he just put in this many $1,000s, and you're a little guy, so why don't you step up to the line? And even if it's not that central figure, I've seen many times how one person brings a name in, and then another person, a little shady, brings somebody else in. And pretty soon there's this whole web of a bunch of people being involved, and nobody really knows what's going on.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And the other thing to remember is the tremendous speculative mentality that existed in the 1920s, not just in Los Angeles, where it was truly at fever pitch, but throughout the nation. I think it's a mistake to see this whole episode as a Los Angeles story, even though it takes place in Los Angeles. Remember, the 1920s is characterized by events like the Florida land boom. There's all sorts of mining swindles. There are other oil swindles. Teapot Dome in the 1920s. There is, of course, the tremendous bull market on Wall Street. This often happens at a time when the economy is expanding rapidly, is creating many legitimate opportunities. And it becomes very difficult for people to distinguish between the legitimate business opportunities and those which are purely speculative. And, of course, you can, if you play your cards right, do very well in a purely speculative venture as long as you get out before everybody else, before the venture collapses. And in the Julian swindle, many of the biggest investors, the members of the million-dollar pool, pulled out and took their profits. Their profits amounted to something like a 78% profit for about 6 months of investment. And then when the company collapsed, it was the tens of thousands of small investors who lost their savings.
Just really quickly, some people don't understand, why is a stock over issue bad? What does it do? And is it always doomed? Is it always a bad idea?
It's usually a bad idea. It depends on the level of the over issue, of course. Stocks are issued usually based in relationship to the prospects for the company. Stocks are issued in order to provide funding for the company to grow and to build. And there are two ways to make money. One is if the stock goes up. But the other thing, of course, if you put out more stocks than you're authorized to, or more stocks than is merited, you can just make money selling those stocks. You can use the paralleling of the classic movie, the Mel Brooks' movie, The Producer, when you know what he decides the way to make money in The Producers is to take a play, the worst possible play, and instead of making a hit out of it, oversubscribing it. And so he makes a musical comedy called Springtime for Hitler oversubscribes it by 1,000% and, of course, gets into trouble when it becomes a smash hit. The same thing happens in the Los Angeles oil boom and in the Julian swindle. The Julian Petroleum Company was authorized to sell about 360,000 shares of stock. Instead, they sold about 5 million shares of stock. So we're not talking here about a minor overissue. We're talking about a massive overissue. A company which was supposedly worth $30 million was actually worth probably about $8 million, sold stock for $150 million. So in that case, of course, an overissue can never be good.
Who got the money?
We don't know entirely. Certainly stockbrokers made lots of money. In many ways, they are the big villains here because they had to know from their own records the stock was overissued. They collected commissions on all the stock they sold. They also manipulated, bulled, and bared the stock on the Los Angeles Stock Exchange to their advantage. Many of the investors who did get out in time, many of the people who engaged in the pools, in the million-dollar pool, in the so-called Tijuana pool, there was a San Francisco pool which involved Senator Hiram Johnson's son, Archie. Lewis was very good at bringing in well-connected, well-known people. Certainly Lewis and Berman made off with millions of dollars, although Lewis always claimed he didn't, and we've never found his money. Berman, it was very clear, had several million dollars stashed away after he got out of prison.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Jules Tigel. He's a professor of history at San Francisco State University. You may remember his last book, Baseball's Great Experiment, Jackie Robinson and His Legacy. I have to say that this to me was not a history book. It was so full of life and the people are so lively. Where did I go wrong? Should I have been a history major? Are they all like this and I was looking
They're
at
the computer? They're not all like this, but quite a number of them are. I think that what attracted me to this story, I first discovered it in a very small synopsis in Carrie McWilliams' classic book, Southern California, An Island on the Land. And I said, that's a nice story. It probably will take me a few years to piece together and has interesting characters. And it ended up taking me about 10 years to piece together the swindle. And it just took more twists and turns than just when I thought I had everything down, there'd be a new twist, a new turn, and the story would just emerge again in the most unexpected fashions.
Well, what were you looking at? How did you find your information that would lead you to new information about the story?
Well, one of the interesting sources that I used were newspaper ads, because both C.C. Julian and later S.C. Lewis sold their stock by advertising in the newspapers. And one of the really important developments of the 1920s was the tremendous expansion of mass marketing and mass advertising. And Julian really was able to tap into that. And so his ads, which were very verbose, often very clever, playing on the speculative desires of people, really also contained a lot of information about his battles with the corporation commissioner, with federal officials, about the state of the company, and S.C. Lewis's ads as well. So he did a lot of research looking through hundreds of newspaper advertisements. There were, needless to say, court records, since there were many, many, many trials coming out of this, newspaper accounts, receivership records, since the company did end up in receivership. And all of these provided quite a lot more than I ever anticipated I'd be able to find.
When I think about stock being sold to you by these sort of personal pleas and ads, I'm always reminded about how information gets to people. And there's a whole big change going on about this time, isn't there?
There's really a tidal shift in the 1920s. I think we would recognize the world of the 1920s more than we would the world before World War I. One of the things that happens is people begin to absorb information, absorb knowledge in a very different way. Prior to this time, it was a much more literary, much more verbal world. Now it became a more visual world. Tabloid newspapers begin right in 1920. Of course, the spread of not just movies, but newsreels. This became photographs. People could actually see these people. People could see pictures of C.C. Julian. People could see, one of the reasons that Lindbergh was such a phenomenon is that you could vicariously be there yourself in the newsreel, watch him take off, watch him land. This wasn't possible for prior generations. By the mid-20s, radio had also revolutionized the way that we absorb knowledge. And we began to see the emergence of a mass market. And what we're seeing here, in a sense, is the discovery also of mass psychology. And advertisers are beginning to, through more visual ads, through ads that are designed much more specifically to go after people and go after their weaknesses. And, you know, industries are forming industrial psychology. Advertising companies are forming, are looking more into the psychology of people. This is all emerging in the 1920s in a way that is truly going to transform the world that we live in. And you would recognize, I think, the ads of the 1920s, the come-ons of the 1920s, much more than you would those of earlier ages.
There isn't a lot of dialogue in the book, but there sure is a lot of, okay, this happened, and then this happened, and that's not a coincidence if you look at that. How did you keep all the details straight?
It wasn't very easy. computers help a lot now in terms of modern technology. It's really a matter of trying to line things up from A to Z, of telling a linear story, telling a story from start to finish. And it is more or less, very often history now is not told chronologically, but this story really lent itself. It had as I like to say, a story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And this one had a wonderful beginning with his arrival and his early successes at Santa Fe Springs. The middle phase, as the company begins to weave its spell and to create the scandal through the over-issues, through the pools, and then an ending in which the company collapses, and there are all sorts of court cases, all sorts of, as you mentioned, assassinations, murders, suicides, and all organized crime figures, religious figures coming in.
Do you think you've gotten any better at spotting a con man?
I think so. I think that if there's a favorite quote I like to use, not from this scandal, but from an old Maverick television show.
That's right.
He always quoted his old pappy, who said, you can fool some of the people all the time and all of the people some of the time, and those are pretty good odds. And and so I think that's the con man's credo. And usually if something looks too good, if it looks like it's too good to be believed, it probably is too good to be believed.
Maybe you could just retell for us the story of the courtroom murder of Motley Flint, and how Robert Shuler played a role in it.
Right. Well, first of all, Robert Shuler is a pioneer radio evangelist. In 1926, when radio was just beginning, he acquired a radio station. Of course, his leading rival in that field in the 1920s in L.A. was Amy Semple McPherson, who had had a station since 1923, who was truly the pioneer media evangelist. But Shuler was very different than Amy was. Amy preached goodness and forgiveness, and Shuler was much more a fire and brimstone preacher who preached not just private but public morality and attempted to clean up the politics of Los Angeles. And so his was very much a political radio show as well as a religious show. And he saw in the Julian Petroleum swindle all of the elements that he felt were plaguing Los Angeles, the corrupt bankers, the corrupt politicians, also attacking, he was very anti-Semitic, and he saw there were several Jewish principals, and he attacked them over the radio. And he helped to fuel a post-swindle, a post-crash fervor against the people who had participated in the Julian scandal. One of the people who listened to the show was a fellow named Frank Keaton. And Keaton, in many ways, was a quintessential Southern California figure. He had move there from the Midwest in the late teens. He had prospered quite a bit, invested in real estate, and made a good deal of money, but then began to invest in the stock market and did not fare as well, and lost a good deal of money as a result of the Julian swindle. He hadn't really invested in Julian stocks, but he did lose money as a result, and of course lost more money when the national stock market crash came in 1929 and became somewhat unbalanced. And he laid the blame on Motley Flint. And in 1930, and he also began listening regularly to Robert Schuller's radio broadcasts and also reading. Schuller would had a magazine, a weekly magazine, and pamphlets. He wrote a pamphlet called Julian Thieves, a second pamphlet called Julian Thieves and Politics, in which he attempted to expose what had happened in the Julian swindle. By 1930, Keaton was seriously imbalanced and mentally unbalanced, and he, Motley Flint was testifying in a courtroom trial that involved David Selznick, the great film producer, and Keaton walked into the courtroom and shot Motley Flint right there and assassinated him right in the midst of the trial.
Right over the shoulder of Selznick's wife.
Right over the shoulder of Selznick's, from his mother, Selznick's mother. And the judge jumped off the stand and wrestled the gun from him, which I don't think judges do very often today. But a very colorful courtroom shooting.
Well, you'd never get the gun in.
I guess today you couldn't get the gun in.
I mean, things have just changed dramatically. But the whole, I think one of the pictures I get is this huge swirl of events that brings different people and different pressures all together. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome.
My guest today has been Jules Tigel. He is a professor of history at San Francisco State University, and his latest book is The Great Los Angeles Swindle, Oil, Stocks, and Scandal During the Roaring Twenties, from Oxford University Press. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Ask me all the time, can you recommend one good book on the internet? Christine Maxwell is the president and CEO of Research on Demand, and Larry Magid writes the nationally syndicated column Computer File. Both have recently written internet-related books. Christine is the author of the New Writer's official Internet Yellow Pages, while Larry is the author of Cruisin' Online, his guide to the new digital highways. These are two very different books, so I pose to them the question, why can't there be just one book?
First reason is there are many authors out there looking for your revenue, so you have to support us all. that's really one of the reasons. There's a lot of competition, and there is an enormous amount of interest in the internet and online services. So clearly, all of the publishing companies and all of the authors who write about this are flocking to this market. But more importantly, there are really many subjects. There is the issue of sort of a strategic look at how to get online and what to do, which is more or less what I do in the Cruisin' Online. And then there are the directory kinds of books, which really focus on what's out there. And the Internet Yellow Pages is an example. NetGuide is another example, where they really look at specifically at content. And there's really a need for all of that. I mean, you really need to kind of have to get started. And once you're up and running, you need to know where to go for further information.
I think I would look at it in a different way, because when one first comes to the internet or tries to find out how to get on it, it's extremely overpowering because there's just so much there that one isn't familiar with. And so, I wrote the New Writer's Official Internet Yellow Pages precisely because I myself had problems in locating information. And everything that was out there was very much focused on the how-to. And what was missing was information about the content of the internet written so that ordinary human beings, as opposed to Martians, could actually find out what was there.
So you were already, you'd gotten on the net.
Yes.
You were all fine.
But I was totally frustrated.
But you couldn't go anywhere once you...
No, it's an issue, really, where is if you actually know what you are trying to find when you before you get on, you actually have more of a motivation to learn how to do it because you know where you're going and why you're going there. Yeah. And so the contents books have actually come after the how-tos, and in a way, if it was the other way around, people might have, you know...
The position I take in Cruising Online, which, by the way, is about America Online, CompuServe, Prodigy, and the Internet, and admittedly, the Internet is only one of the online worlds that I look at, is I admit that this book was out of date the day it came to press. It was probably out of date a week before it came to press. It was accurate a month before because they print very quickly in this industry. But the fact is that anything that you put in print about online is going to be changing because it's a very dynamic world. So once... The tactic I took was to really provide users with a strategy. It's a little bit like a law school education. If somebody goes to law school, they don't learn about every law in the books. What they really learn is how to use a law library, how to do their research, and how to grow and keep up with what's new. And in Cruising Online, yes, I provide you with indexes and looks at all of the various resources that you can find on the commercial online services and a very small sampling of kind of the neat places on the Internet. But more important, I provide you with a roadmap on how to grow, how to learn, how to get these services to reveal themselves to you. And that's very important. You really need to take that attitude that it's going to be a revelation over time, and that as good as a book may be, a directory like the Yellow Pages, as good as it may be, you're going to have more, and there's going to be a lot of new material that's going to evolve.
Well, I think that's part of the first thing, is that some people say Internet or America Online, or they go down the list, and there is a lot of confusion as to what all these things are. So maybe one of the first books, then, is figuring that out.
Yes.
I think it's important for people to understand some of the major differences between the private commercial providers and the Internet itself. Because when you talk about Genie, for example, or Prodigy, you know, they have electronic mail access, which means you can write letters, so to speak, electronically to anybody who has an Internet address. But you can't access all of the information on the Internet from Genie, for example, or CompuServe. Oh. They are like a planet of information unto themselves, and you have to have a membership. You have to subscribe to be able to access that membership. And it's really important that people understand the differences and look at what those worlds of information have to see if it will fit what their information needs are. And it's knowing that, and I think that's why some of what you've done is very helpful.
And by the same token, I think it's important that you realize that the Internet, which is a vast, vast network of networks with an incredible amount of material, doesn't have everything. There's a lot of copyrighted proprietary information, whether it's Associated Press or Times Mirror, New York Times, and thousands of databases, which come at a price. And whether you get to them through the Internet or through a commercial online service like Prodigy, America Online, or CompuServe, someone is going to have to be compensated for access to that information. So you're going to find certain kinds of databases that you're only going to be able to find on a commercial online service, whereas you're going to find other kinds of information that simply would never get into a commercial online service. And there are hundreds of news groups, for example, at the Internet, which the online services wouldn't have any part of because it wouldn't fit with their profiles. The only exception being America Online, which actually gives you access to Internet news groups. But even there, it's a very different experience than getting onto whether it's NetCom or your university Internet provider or any of the hundreds of other Internet services. It's very different. And in Cruising Online, I try to give people a sense of the differences. And I also try to get them to appreciate that there is something to be said for the commercial services, that there really is a lot to be had and to understand what it is you're paying for and why it's necessary to pay for these services.
Now, Christine, you've written a much different book than Cruising Online, which Larry wrote. Tell us about the New Writer's Official Internet Yellow Pages. What does that book do?
It's a comprehensive directory of a broad slash of coverage of what's on the Internet. And its purpose was really to help people who, even if they've never been on a computer, would actually be able to take this directory and open it and access the information there just like they would open a Yellow Pages, and actually find resources that are of interest to them, because all of the resources are listed both alphabetically by title and by a series of keywords. And the importance of that is that people have more than one opportunity of actually finding what they're looking for, as opposed to just one. And the the instigation of that was really to help people have, for the first time, access to the internet, even without knowing anything about how to get on there. Because so many times I've heard people say, well, what's out there? I mean, they just say, well, just get out there and sail to sea and you'll find a port somewhere. Well, yes, eventually you'll get somewhere, that's true. But I mean, it's very frustrating. And so this really helps people to understand that there are many resources of interest to them personally. And then they say, oh, now I know why I want to get on the internet, because there is something really for me.
You know,
that's what that does.
There's something very comfortable that I know how to use the Yellow Pages.
Right.
And there's something very comfortable about picking up your book. It's built like, it looks like, it quacks like. Must be a Yellow Pages. Did you have that in mind when you started, that structure, or did that evolve?
No, I had it very much in mind, because I work in a research business. I've run a company called the McKinley Group and Research on Demand, and we are in the business of helping treat people's information ills, so to speak. They will call us up and say, I need to find a certain piece of information. And so the internet is a whole other world of information that hitherto has not been accessible on the commercial online systems like Dialogue, which are these big vendors that have hundreds of databases mounted online. They're costly to get into, but as Larry said, they have some very, very important bodies of information that are themselves not available on the internet. So the internet isn't the be-all and end-all of information, but it is a fantastic Aladdin's cave, and everything that glistens is indeed gold for somebody. And I hope that what the New Writers Official Internet Yellow Pages does is help people identify where much more easily what is gold for them.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guests today are Christine Maxwell and Larry Maggott. Christine is the author of The New Writers Official Internet Yellow Pages, and Larry is the author of Cruisin' Online, His Guide to the New Digital Highways. With boundless professional credits between them, we're talking about the new wave of books you're finding and we're finding in the bookstores on the information superhighway. Are there other kinds of books, or do your two books, I mean, I get everything, it seems, across my desk, and I put your two together, and I said, well, here's certainly two flavors. Are there other books as well, or does this pretty much describe what people can expect to find out there?
Well, I think you'll find two general categories of books. Again, there's the how-to books, and there's the directory kinds of books, and there are many other books. I happen to think that the books represented on this show are sort of some of the better ones, in the sense that you've got books that are very carefully researched and well-written and tightly edited. One of the things you have to watch for when you're purchasing a book about any aspect of computing is the sort of quickie, let's knock this thing out because it's a fad, book publishing phenomenon. And Cruisin' Online, for example, was 2 years in the writing. I began this book long before there was a plethora of online books out. In fact, had we published it 6 months earlier, we would have been in a field almost to ourselves. But in fact, it's now very trendy to want to read about and to write about the internet and the online world and the so-called digital highway. So you have lots and lots of books out there. So it's really important, before you spend a lot of money, that you spend at least a little bit of time making sure that you're getting something that was done very carefully and is accurate and hopefully well-written and a little bit humorous and sort of a pleasure to be part of.
I think it's that, you know, what you say is also important, in the sense that a lot of the how-to books that are out there, they principally have been organized in chapters that look at individual internet research tools, with sort of odd names like Gopher and FTB and so on. And this is, you know, extremely off-putting to, it's a whole new language which has little meaning to the non-initiated. And so to expect somebody to understand that they should look up about computers under Gopher, it's complete non sequitur. And so I was driven to write this by my unutterable frustration with what I found out there.
Well, you know, I, as a technical person, and I always consider myself someone who goes across the line. Sometimes I'm just a technical person, and sometimes I'm with the rest of us. I like to shift back and forth. there is a whole group of people in the technical area, and often they're the most talented and the most dedicated, who like to have little funny names for things.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually enjoy it. The whole rest of the world really doesn't seem to enjoy this. And so because of this newness of access to all of this technology, there are many people who hold on to those original names, those funny little letters or funny names like gopher, which don't mean a lot of things. And so it's almost like the internet and all the online services are coming into a world now in which everyone is accessing them.
Yeah.
Yes, but the thing is that it's very much a sort of a trend where the technology is at the forefront. And then as the software begins to catch up to intelligently help do the searching sort of almost invisibly, those names won't matter so much anymore,
right.
And they'll begin to go into the background, so to speak.
You know, when I think about the online world, I think back to the movie The Graduate, where Dustin Hoffman was approached by an older gentleman who said, "I have one word," and of course that word was plastics. Well, if I were presumptuous enough to go up to a young man or woman seeking a new career, I would say the big word is content. And the critical issue, when it comes to whether it's the internet or the commercial online services, is not so much the software, the hardware, or ultimately even the interface. It's going to be the content. What are you getting? For that reason, cruising online is organized around content. I don't have a chapter. I don't even have a chapter on America Online and Prodigy. I have a chapter called Kids and Teens, electronic
That's
mail,
right.
forums and clubs, news, weather and sports, travel and shopping, those kinds of games, leisure entertainment, the kinds of things that people are attracted to. I'm very proud about the chapter called Democracy Online because I get a chance to embody my own political philosophy in helping people empower themselves by going online. And that's ultimately the key. It's just as if, you know, we know the adage, you don't judge a book by its cover. What that really means is you don't look at a book simply by the glossy paper or the cover, but you look at what it says. And ultimately, that's how we're going to evaluate online services and internet providers, by the content that they offer. And I think that it's very important that the books reveal the content and help people sift through what's glisten and what's kind of a glitzy interface and get down to what's really useful for them.
Was it hard to get the information for your books?
Finding a lot of information was not the problem, but actually reducing that information to a finite format was extremely hard in the case of this directory, because what we had to develop was a template, essentially, which is a format that lists the title and then a short description, followed by keywords, audience fields, a profile, contact information, details about whether a particular resource is free or has multimedia attached to it, and so on. These are all very specific pieces of information that when you go into a resource on the internet, it isn't all up there for you. It doesn't just say, here it is. You have to actually bury into that content and go through many, many different levels of menus to actually figure out what is the essence of what's there to create the template that we created. It was a great deal of work.
Random House, which is the publisher of Cruising Online, spent a lot of time editing my original manuscript to make sure that I just got to the kernel of things, because, of course, it's very tempting to write a 2,000 or 3,000-page book, and we had to keep it down to well under 500 pages so it would be affordable and understandable. But the joy of writing about online, of course, is you can do all of your research online. You don't have to go anywhere. It's great. You can do it in the middle of the night. It's actually a very fun, I found Cruising Online a really fun book to write because I got to sit there with my three modems and my three phone lines. Late at night, I would actually have all three commercial services running at the same time. I felt like Lyndon Johnson, who used to sit in front of the three television monitors to monitor each of the major networks. Well, I would monitor each of the major computer networks and be able to compare, oh, here's how Prodigy does travel. Oh, here's how America Online does. And in the book, I'm not afraid to say I like this, I don't like that. I'm very comparative. I really try very hard to help people find out who covers what best, because these are very competitive services. And ultimately, most people are going to wind up with one or two. They're not going to wind up with all three. And so even though I give them, through the book, a free month on each of the services and on the internet, after that month is over, they're going to have to pay for them. And so I try to help them make some critical decisions as to what's going to help them. And so I really got a kick out of that sort of you know, cruising literally the digital highway myself for a couple of years as I researched this book.
In your war room at night. Yeah. I like that, with the light.
Oh, yeah. The only thing that was frustrating about the book is that I was shooting in a moving target. Prodigy completely reinvented their interface as the book was about to go to press, which was one of the reasons we came out a little later than we should have. But had we not done that, the book would have been totally out of date. So we had to get that.
Of course, this book is out of date. It was out of date, you know, X minutes after any of these things were done. But it makes the point. It allows people for the first time to get an understanding of the breadth and the depth of information that's out there, that it doesn't matter how specialized their interests are. It gives you the feeling that there's a like-minded individual, or indeed probably many, many individuals out there that you're going to be able to communicate with. And that is what is just extraordinary.
And I'm sure you'll find in both the Yellow Pages and in Cruising Online that it's not completely out of date. I mean, that mainly a question that there are new services that are coming up all the time. Most of the services that I cover on Cruising Online are still there. There are going to be some that go away, but most of the time they're there, but there's just new stuff that comes all the time.
Well, the titles are there, and they've just moved their server, their actual location. And so as long as you have the title, the chances are you're going to be able to type in that title and find it again.
My guests today are Christine Maxwell and Larry Magid. Larry writes the syndicated column Computer File, which appears in the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, and numerous other publications worldwide. Christine Maxwell is president and CEO of Research on Demand and a director of the Santa Fe Institute. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Well, I must say, if people have just listened to that reintroduction there, they say, well, gee, you know, you guys have done a lot and are doing a lot. And many people remember you, Larry, from the Little PC book and other things that you've done. From your experiences, what do you think, from your past experience, help you to figure out what should be in your book?
I have a very eclectic background, and I think that helped enormously in terms of deciding, you know, how to condense information and bring it into the format of the New Writers Official Internet Yellow Pages. I come from Europe originally, and I've taught as a teacher in elementary school both in Europe and in the United States, and have spent many, many years working in publishing in all facets. And so I was very, very familiar with so many different fields of information, and working in the research business, where every day we're faced with people calling in and needing to find specific pieces of information, I have a tremendous breadth of knowledge in terms of knowing how to go for information and where to find it without having to actually be an expert in something. But knowing how frustrating it is to find information, I think it left me with a very great sensitivity towards how to help people have something in their hands that was going to help them so they could help themselves.
I think what Christine and I have in common is that we're not so much technologists as we are people who are focused on helping people find what they need.
Right.
I have a background as a one-time college professor. I've been a social activist during the 60s and 70s. I've written for 12 years now a syndicated column that appears in daily newspapers that are read by average people that don't necessarily have an interest in technology. And my goal in life is to explain these things in ways that make sense to the average person. People don't really care about bits per second or about the various types of computers that are used and the host systems. What they care about is what this information does for them. It's a little bit like television. If I were to describe my experience watching television, it probably wouldn't occur to you to tell you what kind of TV I have, what kind of antenna or cable system I use. I'd probably tell you about some interesting or perhaps boring TV show I may have watched the other night. And that's what I care about. I care about content. It's good, it's bad, it's exciting, it's boring, it's whatever. That's the issue with online, is to try to focus on what gets me excited. And once the sort of the thrill of saying, isn't this neat, I can do it, passed on, what gets me to log on every day, and I do. I do every day log on to America Online, CompuServe, Prodigy. I check the internet because there's something there for me. And what's there for you is different because you have different interests. But what you and I, and I think most of our listeners, have in common is that we all have interests and we all have a desire to be connected. And this connectivity, this idea of sharing, being part of a global community, gets me very, very excited. I actually think it may have some long-term implications for how we survive as a planet if we can find ways to really, in a real kind of way, not just metaphorically, but in a real kind of way to shrink this planet into a global community. I think it has some very, very interesting implications, and I'm real excited to be part of that.
You know, one thing I have to be very clear about your book, one of the things I liked about it was many of the books are how-to books, and they say we're being very objective, we're not telling you anything. But I could always get then at the end, it's like, well, this is my personal reaction, and understand that this is my personal reaction for me, but this is what I thought about that. Yeah. And it wasn't that, oh, you got to go do what Larry says, but you're reading all this information, and then you go, oh, yeah, I see why you would say that. Yeah,
I learned a long time ago that objectivity is a myth. The only thing I do is I'm impartial, and I'm fair. I'm not going to favor any service. I don't have any reason to please anybody. And my constituency is the reader. It's not the services themselves. But sure, I think that, for example, Prodigy is great for kids, and it's a better service for kids than CompuServe. But for a serious researcher who's looking for really in-depth information, CompuServe is terrific. And America Online has a delightful interface. And they're all different, and one size does not fit all. Any more than one radio station is going to be perfect for every listener. One online service isn't perfect for every user, nor is it necessarily the perfect service for every situation. There are times when I flock to CompuServe because I need to get a certain kind of information. The other times when I'll go log on to Prodigy because what I'm looking for is headline news. Just as there are times when I might watch CNN and there are other times I might prefer to watch NBC or HBO. It really depends on what I'm trying to accomplish and who I am.
Now, I have to ask you this, Christine. Did you have to get some special rights or licenses to use the term Yellow Pages?
No, it's in the public domain.
Ah.
It's like a Xerox.
I see it. Kleenex.
Exactly.
Right there. Now, what's official about it? Oh, come on. I can't be the first person to ask you this question.
Actually, you are. You are. I think that it points really to the professional approach to the content. It is very factual and has when I say official, I suppose it's more, it's the professionalism aspect of it that I would attach the official to.
Okay.
I suspect your publisher, like mine, has a marketing department that comes up with creative names for things.
It was a name that seemed to speak to people
From
when it was looked at from a marketing point.
With the Yellow Pages, as we know them, if I want to have a little ad in there, I pay a little more. And that, are people paying to get into your directory?
No, they're not. Each of the resources is selected through an editorial process. And I think it's important to add one other thing, because Larry was saying that the issue really is going to boil down to content. But the complementary issue to that of equal importance, really, which is sort of the next generation, is the issue of value added. In other words, not just here's a resource, but some indication about the value of that resource. You know, how complete is it? Something about, the pedigree of that resource, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And in New Writers Official Internet Yellow Pages, we made a major effort to try to help people understand which resources were likely to give them more information than others. And this is an issue of ranking or ratings, if you like.
So if I have a resource,
yes,
and I want to make sure I'm in your Yellow Pages, the most I can do is beg you. What would I do?
You could send it in, and we certainly would be delighted to receive information, which we can receive either electronically over email or via fax or whatever, because we are constantly looking for new resources. But whether they actually end up in this Yellow Pages, there's only a finite amount of pages. Otherwise, I'd have to give somebody a truck each time they wanted to send it out. So we really have to go through a very special selection process. And that has to do with having editorial advisory boards where individuals of a world caliber in their fields help us decide why one resource would be more worthwhile putting into the Yellow Pages than another.
Christine and Larry, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My guests today have been Christine Maxwell and Larry Maggott. Christine Maxwell is the author of The New Writer's Official Internet Yellow Pages, published by New Writers Publishing. Larry Maggott is the author of Cruising Online, Larry Maggott's Guide to the New Digital Highways, published by Random House. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Barry Evans' perspective today is called Clone to the Stars.
Unless you were lost at sea last year, you probably know something about Jurassic Park, so I won't be giving anything away by saying that the key idea in the novel and movie is that long-dead dinosaurs could be resurrected from fragments of their DNA. I won't dwell on the feasibility of the whole idea. It is a story, after all. But I do want to explore the astronomical implications latent in the plot, particularly as it applies to the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, or SETI. Each cell in our body contains our individual genome, that is, our entire genetic code. Human genome consists of about 3 billion pairs of nucleotide bases, each of which can take one of four configurations, as Watson and Crick showed when they unraveled the structure of DNA over 40 years ago. The amount of information in the genome of a human, or dinosaur for that matter, is equivalent to the information encoded on a compact disk, about 680 megabytes. You can speculate that in the future, when you pay a visit to the doctor, you'll carry your personal CD, on which will be encoded your own genome. Suppose Michael Crichton's fictional Jurassic Park becomes fact one day, that we will be able to produce living creatures from their DNA. Let's start off with, well, yours. Pop your personal CD into a gene machine, and out will come, well, I'm not sure, but in theory, I suppose, a fertilized egg, which could be grown in a test tube into a carbon copy of you. Take this one step further. If you can put it on a CD, you can transmit it on radio waves across space. What's to stop you beaming an exact facsimile of yourself in the form of your DNA sequence, complete with user instructions, to, say, Antares, the bright orange star in the constellation Scorpius? Before long, your clone could be walking around on an Antarian planet. Let's look at it from the other point of view. Could extraterrestrials transmit themselves here? I suspect those of us who have thought much about it imagine that if one of the SETI programs does detect an intelligent signal, and of course that we can interpret it, the contents might turn out to be a greeting. Hi, how are you? We're fine. The weather here is terrible, but our three suns make up for a lot. Do stay in touch. Or perhaps they'd send us the latest version of the Encyclopedia Galactica. We'd get information in the form of words and pictures anyway. But suppose, instead, we were to receive instructions to build a few of them. Then what? Would we give the ETs citizenship? Could they claim Social Security benefits? You see the problems that might result. Much better, I think, would be for them to send sufficient information for us to create a virtual reality program to emulate the environment of their planet. That way we could visit their home without leaving ours. Now that's what I call getting the best of both worlds.
Barry Evans is the author of the syndicated column Star Watch. His most recent book is Everyday Wonders, Encounters with the Astonishing World Around Us. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.